Hello and welcome to Popcorn Mumbles, the podcast where we dig into the back catalog to select a film or television show to rewatch. I'm your host, Cody Nestor. Alongside me is my co-host, Todd Heal.
What's going on, guys?
This week, we have chosen the 1964 film Goldfinger. The powerful tycoon Auric Goldfinger has initiated Operation Grand Slam, a cataclysmic scheme to raid Fort Knox and obliterate the world economy. James Bond, armed with a specially equipped Aston Martin, must stop the plan by overcoming several outrageous adversaries. Goldfinger was released in the U.S. on December 22, 1964. On a budget of $3 million, it made $125 million. It has a Rotten Tomatoes score of 99% and an audience score of 89%. So, Todd, let's discuss Goldfinger. Spoilers are ahead.
Okay.
So, Todd, let's start off. What is James Bond's assignment this time around?
So, we get the kind of pre-credits teaser, which doesn't have anything to do with the movie.
The first the first instance of that, the opening credits scene, having nothing to do with the actual narrative of the rest of the film, that kind of give the producers a way to kind of get us right into the action and introduce us to what's going on with Jimmy Bond and his adventures in a more mellow way after that opening credit scene.
So basically we pick him up. He's in Miami. He kind of thinks he's on maybe a little bit of a vacation, but he runs into his old pal Felix Leiter, and he lets him know that wants to keep an eye on a guy that's staying there called Auric Goldfinger. They kind of got, suspicions.
Sounds like a French nail varnish, Todd.
That's what Jimmy thinks anyway. So they kind of, they want him to keep an eye on him. The government's kind of got their suspicions of him. We see Goldfinger come down. Leiter tells him that there's this guy he's been cleaning out every day at cards, just wiping him out, playing gin. James is a little bit suspicious of that. He kind of realizes Goldfinger's got a setup up in his room. He kind of makes his way up there, forces a maid to open the door for him.
Yeah, right.
Goes in and sees Goldfinger's accomplice, Jill Masterson. And Jill's kind of, she's cheating with Goldfinger. She's watching the other guy's hand, telling Goldfinger what he's playing. Bond puts a quick stop to that. I love how he kind of flicks the mic, messes up Goldfinger's hair, and attention, Goldfinger.
Yeah, and then pretty much from there, he has a nice little evening with Jill, I would say.
Right.
Takes a little break from their activities to go get another chilled bottle of, Dom Perignon?
Dom Perignon.
Ends up getting a little Judy chop to the back of the head by Goldfinger's henchman that we'll come to see later, Odd Job. I guess first off, Todd, what is it? I know this is your favorite Bond film, right?
It's my personal favorite, yes.
So what is it that makes Goldfinger your favorite Bond film?
For me personally, I think you've built a strong foundation with Dr. No, From Russia with Love. I think for me personally, you've hit the apex of the series right here. And in a way, it's a little bittersweet because you're kind of leaving behind some of the just pure espionage spy stuff. And you're kind of crossing over into super spy territory now.
Right.
But I think Goldfinger, maybe more than any other of the Bond films, kind of walks that line perfectly.
Yeah. It's also it's also a little sad, too, because it's a little bit diminishing returns from here.
Right.
For a number of years, I think. We haven't went back and watched Thunderball yet. That's our next up for Bonduary. But I don't remember too much about how I felt about Thunderball, but I know getting into some of the later Connerys, obviously we got a George Lazenby coming up as well. A little sidetrack into Lazenby territory. But yeah, it's a little bit sad too because we hit our apex in the third movie and then we slowly go down for a while.
Yeah, and you start to get right here in Goldfinger, you kind of get sort of the final pieces of the template that kind of defines this series, I would say at least through the Brosnan era.
Yeah, because this time we really solidify those opening credits.
Right.
We've got Shirley Bassey this time actually belting out the Goldfinger main title track and the opening credits. We have it very good opening credits. Like, again, we kind of get that little bit of that From Russia with Love vibe where the kind of the scenes of the things we haven't seen yet are kind of projected onto our golden ladies.
Right.
But yeah, we kind of nail down the opening credits. We talked about it kind of nails down the pre-opening credits, like having nothing to do with it, just big action set piece to get us in there. Obviously, we'll talk about it later on, but we get the car.
Oh, yeah.
we get a little bit more quippy this time. There's a few other kind of quips and stuff, but we have the main heavy, and then we have like the mini boss.
Right. Because
we have, you know, Goldfinger as our main, and then we have his really the first henchman, like in the Bond films. Like you go back to From Russia with Love, you had Red Grant, but he's not really so much, I mean, he is a henchman, but he's just another spy. He's just another man doing a job.
Right.
Whereas Odd Job, he's your first kind of henchman in the vein of like a Jaws, and the characters we'll kind of see later. So it does lay that groundwork for like some of the best things. And we get more gadgets here than ever.
Yeah.
From you know, Q coming in compared to From Russia with Love, which was mostly just a briefcase, and Dr. No, which was just barely anything, a Geiger counter and something else, you know. So it really does lay that foundation, like you said. Talking about the opening credits, what is the better opening credits? Dr. No, From Russia with Love, or this?
You know, I'm probably going to have to go Goldfinger here.
Right.
It's the first one I think that is really, I mean, I love the Dr. No opening credits. I think they are really good. From Russia with Love, I think are decent and good as well. But I think this Goldfinger one is iconic. I think it's a lot to do with Shirley Bassey.
Yeah.
I mean, Shirley Bassey can, like, you know, sing a menu and win 2 Grammys.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it really does. It adds something. Like, you know, the first two were just kind of instrumental. And, I mean, they're great. But, like, having that, it's just you associate Bond opening credits with someone kind of, you know, having a good, you know, belting out a good number. And Goldfinger is still one of the best out of the 20-plus Bond films that we have.
Belting out a song and holding a note to almost to the point of blacking it.
Yeah, exactly. Apparently her and Tom Jones had the same kind of experience in Thunderball next. Let's talk about a little bit of the gadgets, because I want to hit on one here. But our gadgets in this film, the first one we see, and I totally forgot about, is the seagull headgear.
Seagull, yeah.
I was like, I didn't really think about what it was. When I wrote my notes originally, I was like, waterfowl headgear. I was like, oh, it's a seagull. Seagull headgear and the grapple gun is what he uses. He's basically in somewhere in, I guess, South America, I guess, blowing
kind
of drug operation is really, again, doesn't really transfer over to the actual main story. Did you notice the grapple gun? It looks a little weird when he fires it. Did you notice that? He, like, points it, it fires, and then the rope comes out of nowhere.
I kind of caught that, yeah.
And at first I was like, is it because the lead of the grapple is, like, kind of connected to the rope and pulls it along? But then you see this back shot of it, and it's, like, rope right to hook, but that's not how it fires.
Right.
Just a little nitpick to me. I'm like, this looks weird.
A little off, yeah.
That looks a little weird. Our other gadgets, though, we get homing devices. We get the big homing device that he ends up putting in a car later on. We get a smaller heel size version that goes in his shoe. We also get the classic Aston Martin DB5 tire. There's not better, many better movie cars, I would say.
You're hard pressed to find one.
I mean, the Batmobile comes to mind. Those kind of things. Like, it's hard to beat that Aston Martin DB5. And, like, again, it's such a, when you think Bond, you think about that car.
Exactly. And it's like the first one that comes to my mind.
Exactly.
And there are some good cars on down the line, too, don't get me wrong, in this series.
Right.
But that DB5 is
the best,
just,
of course, being the one from Tomorrow Never Dies, right?
Oh, exactly. Yeah.
Also, James Bond's watch in this film is a Rolex Submariner 6538 as well. We're kind of introduced in the beginning, a little bit during our scene in Miami with Felix, we see a couple of Bond girls. We see Dink.
Dink. Very briefly.
Very briefly we see Dink. She is kind of, I guess, a masseur of some sort.
She was kind of giving him a massage, yeah.
Yeah. When Felix comes along, she's quickly shuffled away with a nice little open hand ass slap. Man talk, Dink.
Man talk, Dink.
Run along.
Get on out of here.
Dink, say goodbye to Felix. Man talk.
Before that, I actually forgot one. We have Bonita. She is the
lady in the overseas country.
And you get that classic. It's in pretty much all Bond compilations you ever see of that, seeing the goon approaching in the woman's eyes and quickly turning her to take the blackjack to the back of the head, because Jimmy gives no F's about a dirty lady taking a blackjack to the back of the head.
I always liked how he looked at the guy. He fried in the tub, and he's like, shocking.
Yes.
Then he looks down at her on the way out. Positive, absolutely shocking. Like, looking at her like, I can't believe you set me up before we even got down to business.
Yeah, he just slaps that lamp right into that bathtub. And then we get Jill Masterson, who doesn't make it long. She, once Bond gets Judy chopped in the back of the neck, he awakes to her in the bed, completely covered in gold paint, which is one of the most iconic, images of the 60s and film in general, is Jill being covered in paint. He explains to M later she died of skin suffocation because, you know, you're supposed to leave a small open patch at the small of the back, which she didn't. I was just thinking about how long was Odd Job there?
If he did that job himself, he was there a while.
Yeah, I was going to say, if I made a modern day remake of Goldfinger, I would just have like where it looked like he just tossed buckets of gold paint onto her.
Right.
Like, is how I would execute that scene in modern day, because, like, I thought about it, like, man, Jimmy was out for a while.
He was down for a while.
Did they bring in a crew? Was it just Odd Job with a little paintbrush, you know, like a house brush? Did they bring in five or six other guys? They're like, oh, let's paint this bitch and get out of here.
Like, did you catch that little line where he's going back to get the other bottle of Dom Perignon and he's talking about drinking it above a certain temperature? It's just not done. Mm-hmm. Kind of like listening to the Beatles without earmuffs. Getting a little insinuation that Jimmy ain't too fond of the Beatles.
Yeah. I can't say that I've listened to too many Beatles tracks throughout the years either.
He seems more like a classical kind of guy.
Yeah, probably so. So what is Goldfinger's actual plan here, Todd?
So once we get back to MI6, we kind of have a meeting with M and Bond and another dignitary type guy. And we kind of learned that they got suspicions that Goldfinger is doing some smuggling. You know, he's basically taking his gold. It's worth a certain price in this country. He's somehow smuggling into another country and selling it for more than it's worth in his country. They got their suspicions of him.
And I love how he's actually smuggling the gold in. Tell us how he smuggles his gold in.
It's in his car.
He's got this nice-ass car, and it's literally all made up of smelted down gold parts. That has to be a heavier car, right?
You would think. I mean, that thing's got to weigh some stuff.
I would just imagine. I just like a scene where they're like pulling out of somewhere, and you just see all four tires pop. Just
kind of under the weight of all that
under
gold.
Under the weight of all
and
the gold.
Car frame.
Exactly. Continue about Goldfinger. What else is he up to here?
So basically, Bond wants to have a meeting with him. Of course, socially, he always wants to meet his adversary socially. So
right.
We pick him up at a golf country club. He gets kind of introduced to Goldfinger, even though he's met him before.
Yeah, exactly.
And actually play a round of golf. Odd Job caddies for Goldfinger, of course. And we get, like, I guess just a standard club caddy for James.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, who's very into the little back and forth him and Goldfinger has. He's very much into
He's Bond. Eating that stuff up. Yeah,
he's very much into Bond making a fool out of Goldfinger.
Yeah, he's down for that.
There's a point where Goldfinger hits a bad shot and kind of loses his ball. Odd Job drops, hit the golf ball type that he actually uses, which is supposed to be a Schlesinger 1. Bond has previously found a Schlesinger 7, and they're instantly wary of, like, there's no way that's his ball. And then once James makes the switch to kind of play around and screw Goldfinger over, the caddy's he's just loving him.
He loves it. He laughs his ass off.
Yeah, what is that like? We've got him now, sir.
We've got him now,
like,
sir.
I was like, this guy's really working for his tip today. But what else do we learn about Goldfinger's actual overall plan as we go forward here, Todd?
So we get a name drop of an operation called Operation Grand Slam.
Is that at Denny's?
It's a big breakfast, boy.
Big breakfast at Denny's.
And actually, James has to name drop it to save his own skin, because we get that other iconic scene where he's strapped down to the table.
Yeah.
Goldfinger's got that laser coming right towards you. You're going to split him right in two, heading for his crotch.
Yeah, there's never, again, there's never a compilation of James Bond clips that you will never not see that clip in. Again, one of the most iconic things. I read something about it was originally supposed to be a buzzsaw.
Yeah, they thought that was kind of too cliched by now.
Yeah, too unoriginal, so it changed to the laser. Yeah, but just super iconic. Again,
we get that classic line, "Do you expect me to talk?" And he's like, "No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die."
Exactly. Let me pause right there for a second. I did not know something about this film. I did not know that Goldfinger's voice is dubbed over.
It was, yeah. I knew that. Yeah.
I never knew that. I was going in and doing some research last night and just getting some notes and stuff for, you know, we do some Bond bits later on. And I was like, what? I was like, this guy's voice was dubbed over completely by another actor because I guess Gert Frobe, who plays Goldfinger, his English wasn't as good. There's clips on YouTube, and I'll actually put in a clip of Gert Frobe's actual voice line from a trailer that they use. I'll put that in here.
I think you've made your point, Goldfinger. Thank you for the demonstration. Choose your next witticism carefully, Mr. Bond. It may be your last. Do you expect me to talk?
No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die.
And I went back and listened to that clip. His real voice sounds even better to me.
Right.
You'll have to check out that clip if you hadn't, but I never knew. I would have never, unless you told me, I would have never knew that his voice was dubbed
over. It's a very seamless dub, too. If you didn't know it, you wouldn't know it.
Exactly. But continue, Todd. What's our ultimate goal here?
So Bond's, you know, he's getting ready to die. We got the laser heading straight up his straddle, and he's trying to figure out how to get out of this. And he's like, "Well, what about Operation Grand Slam? If I get killed, 008 replaces me. He knows what I know."
There was something I read too about people always thought that line about Goldfinger, where Goldfinger says he would be replaced by his. I can't remember how he phrases it. Like he would his not his better, but like basically the line people. Thought that he meant that he would be replaced by another like 00 from MI6 and that like MI6 was compromised. Do you know what I'm talking about? Do you know that line I'm talking about?
I think I know what you're talking about, yeah.
But like I was reading it's actually supposed to be that he just meant like that someone else from like another organization, you know, would try to attempt the same kind of thing, not that MI6 had been breached, so to speak. It's just something I read. I wish I could remember the line. I can't because I suck. Anyway, continue.
And so James, of course, names drop Operation Grand Slam, and, you know, he's like, you know, they know what I know. I know about it. They know about it. And Goldfinger kind of pauses, and he's like, yeah, it's probably just something you've heard. Two words that don't mean nothing to you. And he's like, yeah, but can you take that chance?
Right.
Goldfinger's like, maybe I can.
Right.
And we got a little bit ahead of ourselves because when we get to, I think it was Geneva.
Switzerland.
Yeah.
Yes.
That is some of the most beautiful. That winding road, those mountains, that scenery is amazing.
Yeah, I was actually going I was actually thinking about that when I was watching. I'm like, this is probably the most stylistically and visually interesting of the first three Sean Connery films. But you're right, the stuff in Geneva. And we should set up too a little bit of her character because she's not in it very long.
Nope, she don't hang around often.
We get Jill Masterson at the beginning. She was obviously killed by suffocated with the gold paint. James kind of meets along the trail in Switzerland while trailing Goldfinger. He meets a lady named Tilly. He ends up using one of his gadgets in the car, which is kind of like a way to destroy tires. It kind of jets out of his rims.
Right.
He ends up destroying not only her front tire, most of the quarter panel, side panel, all the way back to
the other back tire.
To the other back tire, which I'd have been a little sus. They remarked that they've never seen anything like that, and no one else has in history because. His car actually did it, but he ends up giving her a ride to the next like kind of gas station. He notices a TM written on her little case in the back.
Yeah, and she gives him like a fake name, and he knows that doesn't match up to the initials on that case.
I really liked, and I kind of wonder too if it was kind of a callback that I never thought about. I don't know if it actually is, but. When she first kind of is in Switzerland, she kind of like is trying to pass him in the car and she's like going around him. He's like, you hear the engine rev and he's like, discipline, 007, discipline. He doesn't kind of chase her. And I was thinking, is it a callback later on in GoldenEye when he does chase on a top? I was like, is that kind of, it's very similar in a way
because
he does indulge in the chase there and does kind of chase after the girl.
Right.
So I was like, is that a callback to GoldenEye? I guess maybe when we get around to GoldenEye, maybe we'll find out.
And some of the nod,
behind the scenes. But the lady he gives a ride to is actually Tilly Masterson, sister of Jill Masterson. She actually ends up taking a shot. You think she's taking a shot at James later on, But she's actually trying to hit Goldfinger, and it's like the worst shot ever.
We just find out she's a horrible shot.
Yeah, she's a horrible shot. But she doesn't stick around long. In a scene where in one of the chase scenes, it's probably the big chase scene in the movie. I guess they're in, is it Ark Enterprises at that point where they're at?
Yeah.
James has to end up escaping with her, and there's like a car chase, and he's being chased by all of Goldfinger's kind of, I guess they're like Southeast Asian goons.
Yeah.
He's got, I guess, because we'll see later on that some of the Chinese had kind of shipped in his goons from overseas, but it's a lot of Southeast Asian guys chasing Bond, chasing Tilly in the car. You get a great use of the gadgets on the car. You get the like the smoke screen. You get the oil slick.
Right.
I really love the oil slick because one of the goon cars hits the oil slick, goes off a hill, and explodes for no reason. Did you notice that? It's not on fire. It's not been shot. It hits some oil on the ground.
Goes over the side.
Boom, boom. It's just, I was like, oh, that's the 60s, baby. That's how we roll in the 60s. But eventually Bond and Jill are kind of cornered. He tells her to run on his signal. She runs towards it in the woods. Here comes Oddjob with his steel-brimmed hat, though, just thrown through the woods right into Tilly's neck.
Yeah, kills her.
And she's not in the movie long. You think, kind of at first, you think, is she going to be hanging around? Is she our, like, main love interest that James is going to be in the final scene somewhere while someone else discovers him, and they just be like, we're going to have sex, you go away. like he does at the end of For Russia with Love and right. All these other films. Like, no, she's taken out.
Pretty quickly.
Both Masters and Sisters are removed from the film very quickly. Almost as quickly as they're introduced, they're taken out of the film.
Yeah, they're gone.
All right, Todd, so what is Operation Grand Slam really?
So basically, Operation Grand Slam is Goldfinger's master plan to he's got Delta 9 nerve gas, which is deadly, by the way.
Yeah.
He's going to use a aerial assault. We'll get into who leads that assault just a little bit later here.
Right.
He's going to knock out everyone in and around Fort Knox. He's going to use the laser that he used to intimidate James Bond to kind of cut into the side of the building, get into Fort Knox. We find out he's got a nuclear device, and he's not going to break in to steal any gold. He's going to detonate that little device and make the United States gold reserve useless for, like, I think he said 58 years.
58 years, yeah. The plan is not to move the gold, to take it, to steal it. It's to irradiate it, to make it useless, basically.
Thereby making his gold supply worth 10 times more.
Exactly, and sowing despair and distress into the West as well. I was looking at it last night, and I was like, I wonder if anybody, because on its face, just thinking about it, me being the uneducated chap that I am, I was like, that's a good plan. It's a good movie plan.
Right.
Like,
right.
It's a fantastic movie plan. Like, is it really feasible? I was actually looking up some articles last night to see if anyone had really kind of broken it down. I just kind of had some notes here from a site that I'd found that, one of the big problems with Goldfinger's plan is that the gold really doesn't need to be touched by anybody for it to still be viable for the economy.
Right.
The note here that I have, were this not enough, the radiation would not be a permanent effect. Goldfinger admitted the gold would be rendered useless for 58 years. However, this calculation was not quite correct. Due to only one isotope of gold having a nuclear half-life of more than a few days, the gold would have actually been safe within 1 month.
Wow. So not too viable.
That month, though, that'd have been hell. That'd have been a hell of a month, Goldfinger. You got us for a month. But after that, my guy, we're fine.
But as a diabolical movie plot, wow.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And that's all it needs to be. And, like, you don't need to really think about it. It works narratively. And then, like, as far as a Bond movie plot, like, it's really good. And there's a nice scene where Bond and Goldfinger are talking about it, and he kind of lets Bond figure out the plan. And it's really good narrative little driven scene there that I liked.
Right.
Who is it that does pull off the distribution of the Delta 9 gas, Todd?
So after Goldfinger decides to let Bond hang around and live, they trank him. We see Bond kind of waking up. He's kind of visions coming and going. We kind of get the vision of a lady in front of him. And
imagine.
Yeah, and imagine that, right? And she introduces herself as Pussy Galore.
Again, you'll never see a James Bond compilation where you don't see that. My name is Pussy Galore.
Exactly.
Like, you'll, like, never.
I must be dreaming.
Exactly.
And for a series that is known for, like, kind of on-the-nose women names? Here's, has there ever been one more spot on or in your face than Pussy Galore?
No way. Exactly. And that, again, that might be a subtle symptom of problems to come. It still works here.
Right.
Somehow, I don't know how it works here.
But it does.
It does. In other movies where, like, they really lean into that stuff, especially in the Moore era.
Exactly.
It really gets a little too ridiculous. Obviously, that's why you get parodies like Austin Powers with, like, Halata for China and Random Task and stuff. Because, like, I think the producers and, like, the directors of these films later on, they just kind of pulled on some of this stuff and kind of like, what is Bond? Let's throw it in a blender. Oh, it's really kind of some crass innuendo and kind of crazy names and gadgets.
Exactly.
And you lose, like you said, you lose the good espionage stuff that this started out on. So Goldfinger is an amazing film, but it is a little bit of a double-edged sword when
it's
comes to...
It's kind of the beginning of a drop-off.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Take us through the very end of the film here, Todd. How do we wrap things up?
So, Bond being Bond, he manages to convince Pussy Galore to not disperse that Delta 9 nerve gas over Fort Knox. Something is dispersed, but I don't think it maybe this, you know, just regular gas. Maybe it was empty tanks, who knows?
Right.
But we kind of get our first nod that something's not quite right to plan when we see Felix Leiter kind of knocked out one of those vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
They're at Fort Knox. Goldfinger thinks he's going ahead with his plan, but, you know, the military revives their back. They show up to kind of stop the plan. You kind of get a notion that Goldfinger is maybe thinking something might go south because he rips off the clothes he had on to reveal a U.S. military uniform, puts on a little hat, pulls out a golden pistol. So is he the first man with a golden gun?
Absolutely, absolutely.
You know, Bond is left there chained to the nuclear device. He's trying to figure out how to shut it off. Before that, he has a little bit of a battle with Oddjob after he gets the keys to the cuff and releases himself. Iconic scene where Oddjob throws his hat. It gets caught in those metal bars. There was a little bit of a scene earlier where he throws it and like kind of disconnects a power cable.
Mm-hmm.
Oddjob goes for his bowler. As soon as he reaches for it, Bond slides in with that power cable and electrifies the bars, just shocking him to death.
Another shot you'll see in all Bond compilations.
You always see
again,
that shot.
Again, this is the apex, really. Like, it never...
You just go, iconic scene, iconic scene, iconic scene.
Absolutely.
So Bond is free. He's trying desperately to shut off that nuclear device. He's pulling that wires, looking at this, looking at that. We kind of see, like, I guess a government agent come down. He just kind of flips a switch. Of course, we get the little shot of the timer, and what's it stop on, Cody?
007,
007, baby.
Yeah, I read that they were wanting it to stop on, like, 3, but one of the producers was like, it needs to be on 007, and it does.
That's iconic. It works.
It works. It absolutely works. One thing we were talking about before the podcast I didn't really think about, you had a note kind of about the characterization of Pussy Galore and maybe some kind of under the surface stuff that may have not been noticed. Into that.
If you're like a lot of the audience that maybe watched these movies, and me and Cody definitely, you know the movies, you don't know the books.
Yeah.
And there's kind of...
By the way, this is the 7th in the Ian Fleming James Bond series, by the way, the 7th book.
So when they're on Goldfinger's private jet, I think they're flying to his stud farm in Kentucky. You know, James is already in full Bond mode trying to do the wooey and the pitchy.
Right.
And she kind of, I forget what he says to her, and she kind of turns back and gives him this line is, you know, you can drop all the charm, I'm immune. And, you know, her entire flying circus is all female.
Yes, with very pointy bras,
You put an eye out with them, babies.
Exactly.
So, but we do learn in the novel that, you know, Pussy Galore was a lesbian. And you kind of get that insinuation in the movie just from those lines.
Yes.
Which makes the scene in the barn.
when Bond forces himself upon her.
Yeah.
And she begrudgingly goes with it.
Yeah, you know, that's the power of 007, baby.
That's the power of sexual assault, baby.
Oh, Lord.
Todd, you want some Bond bits here?
Yeah.
You ready for some Bond bits all up in you?
No.
The movie was the fastest grossing movie in movie history when it was released and was entered into the Guinness Book of World Records. Aston Martin was initially reluctant to part with two of their cars for the production. The producers had to pay for the Aston Martin, but after the success of the movie, both at the box office and for the company, they never had to spend money on a car again.
Nice.
Imagine that.
Yeah.
Something we forgot to mention, the classic ejector seat scene.
Oh, yeah.
And the line delivery earlier in the film where Q shows him the ejector seat, and it's like, ejector seat, you're joking. Again, another iconic line, another iconic scene.
Right.
Exactly. But
Iconic moment that shows up later where Bond actually goes to Q's lab to draw his weaponry.
Instead of Q coming to M's lab, yes.
You see all those little side gags or like somebody getting shot with a bulletproof coat.
Yeah. I would hate to be the guy testing that out. When Dame Shirley Bassey recorded the theme song, we kind of mentioned this before, she was singing the opening credits were running on the screen in front of her so that she could match the vocals. When she hit her final high note, the titles kept running, and she was forced to hold the note until she almost passed out, and it echoes the experience of Sir Tom Jones when he was recording the Thunderball 1965 theme as well.
Go for it.
This was something I thought was crazy. Sir Sean Connery never traveled to the United States to film this movie.
I saw that.
Every scene in which he appears to be in the U.S. was filmed at Pinewood Studios outside London. This explains why Bond flips a light switch down to discover the golden corpse of Jill, as British light switches are generally turned on by flicking them down instead of up. According to director Guy Hamilton, that's something we should mention too. Guy Hamilton takes over from Terrence Young here, right. Our first director for Dr. No and for
From Russia with Love.
He would come back later, I think, to do The Man with the Golden Gun. He does Thunderball, if I'm not – was it Thunderball? Hang on one second. I have the note here of Guy Hamilton. Guy Hamilton will come back to direct Diamonds Are Forever, Live and Let Die, and The Man with the Golden Gun. But Terrence Young would come back for Thunderball. Let me see here. Lost my place. Ooh, there we go. According to director Guy Hamilton, Felix was the only main actor in the Miami sequence who was actually there. Connery, Gert Frobe, Shirley Eaton, Margaret Nolan, so on and so forth, all filmed their parts when filming started in Britain with rear projections used, and in the case of Frobe, stand-ins used for the long shots. I'd never have known that. Did you like how when Jill is looking at Goldfinger like cheating and Bond is like, you know, screwing with him, he like snaps that pencil and you hear it snap?
Right.
You couldn't hear that.
You couldn't have heard that snap.
This was the first appearance of a laser beam in a 007 movie. And we mentioned it was a buzzsaw originally. The recreation of Fort Knox repository at Pinewood Studios was incredibly accurate, considering no one involved in this movie had been allowed inside the real location for security reasons. The set looked so real that 24-hour guard was placed on the Fort Knox set at Pinewood Studios so that pilferers would not steal the gold bar props. A letter to the production from the Fort Knox controller congratulated Sir Ken Adam and his team on the recreation. Art Goldfinger's 3D model map used for his Operation Grand Slam is now housed as a permanent exhibition at the real Fort Knox.
That is cool.
Pussy Galore, Honor Blackman, introduces herself to James Bond, Sir Sean Connery, who replies, "I must be dreaming." The original script had Bond replying, "I know you are, but what's your name?"
Oh.
Yeah. Mm.
That's a little bit too much on the nose.
I didn't know she was from The Avengers.
I've saw some of that show, but I remember hearing that, but I never saw any episodes with her on it. Apparently, she quit the show to do the movie.
Exactly, yeah. Yes. The line was deemed too suggestive and was changed or bleeped in some markets around the world, especially for the country of India. We talked about it before that Gert Frobe's voice was dubbed over. He spoke very little English, and British actor Michael Collins dubbed his voice in the film. The producers wanted Orson Welles to play Auric Goldfinger, but Welles was too expensive. Then Gert Frobe began arguing over his salary. He wanted 10% from the movie's earnings, prompting the producers to wonder whether Welles would have been cheaper after all. Ian Fleming partially based the title character of his original 1959 novel Goldfinger on the controversial modernist architect Erno Goldfinger. When he learned that Fleming was naming the villain of his new James Bond novel Goldfinger, the architect threatened to file a lawsuit against Fleming's publisher in an effort to stop the book's publication. Fleming's publisher then contacted the author to inquire whether Fleming might consider renaming the character and the novel. Fleming replied that he'd been delighted to alter the name if he could change the name of the character in the novel to Gold Prick.
Okay.
Something I didn't include here, but I understand Ian Fleming got to visit the set of Goldfinger, but he never actually got it to see completion. I think he died a few months before it was actually released, which is unfortunate because I think, again, this was the apex.
He missed the best one, yeah.
Exactly. And the last note I had, we kind of hit it on here. You kind of beat me to it. Goldfinger does wear yellow items or golden items of clothing in virtually every scene. In the one scene that he appears not to, which wears a U.S. Colonel's Army uniform, he carries a golden revolver. Thus, in the chronology of James Bond films, he is the first man with a golden gun.
He was. And we totally forgot about his death, but...
Yeah, actually, we did totally forget about it. But he gets sucked out of a plane.
He gets sucked out of a side of an airplane.
Yeah, he gets sucked out of a plane. That's the ending there, folks.
Right.
So, Todd, anything else, final thoughts wise?
I had a little note. It's what I like to call the Bond Trinity, and that is Bernard Lee as M, Lois Maxwell as Moneypenny, and Desmond Llewellyn as Q. They were mainstays on this series through three Bond eras, Connery, Lazenby, and Moore. I think we lost Bernard Lee somewhere in the Moore era. Mm-hmm. Just all three tremendous actors. Any of their scenes with any 007 are just awesome.
Yeah.
Three greats. The OGs, you can't ever hardly ever beat the OGs, folks.
absolutely. Their interplay, you know, the dynamic between M and Q, it's friendly, and there's a little bit of there's that. It's kind of like there's a little bit of that boss subordinate, but it's also right. Like you can tell they've been through some stuff, and they have a little bit of quippy exchange, kind of, especially when Bond is like showing off about knowing like that bourbon. I think they're drinking with the guy from the bank.
Yeah,
like just little yeah. scenes like that are great.
He never loses a chance to chastise Bond a little bit if he can.
Exactly,
it's a great dynamic.
Exactly. So Todd, you ready to give us your review for Goldfinger?
I'm ready.
All right, hit us with it.
Folks, we've hit the top of the mountain here, in my opinion. We can maintain at times. We kind of rise close to, and unfortunately sometimes we fall below. But I don't think we ever reach the heights that we reach at Goldfinger here. It's just one iconic scene after another, one iconic image, location, stellar cast. This one's worth its weight in gold, pun intended. Goldfinger, for me, gets a 9. It is an amazing Bond movie.
Yeah, I echo all that. It is the apex of the Bond franchise. It is gives us probably the most iconic or some of the most iconic scenes in all of James Bond history. It's a fantastic film. It works on every level. There's a few things that you could nitpick here or there, but as far as a narrative-driven James Bond film with some good espionage, and it builds some things that would stay with the character for the next 50-plus years, it absolutely hits everything that it sets out to do. I agree with you. I also give it a 9 out of 10. Which ranks it as amazing. So, Todd, can you tell everyone how they can find us and stay up to date with us on social media?
We are at Tau Capes on YouTube, Twitter, and Instagram, Tau Capes Podcast on Facebook. You can also email us at talcapespod@gmail.com.
If you enjoy the show, please consider following us on your podcast platform of choice and subscribing to our YouTube channel. Popcorn Mumbles will return next week. We want to thank you so much for listening. Until next time, bye, guys.
See you guys.